Welcome, everyone, to Spiral Leadership Radio. I'm Arlia Hoffman, along with
Mark Elberfeld. Welcome.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Doing all right. How about yourself?
I'm great. It's good to be on the radio with you again.
Likewise. It's been a while.
So today's topic is the classic, I guess I'm going to call it classic national bestseller called Flow by
Mihai Csikszentmihalyi.
Thank you. I can do it too.
You can. Mihai, you did it very well.
Mihai Csikszentmihalyi.
Good.
Thank you. And if you are in any way creative or interested in psychology and the psychology of creativity, this is not a new book to you. It's not a new book to me or you, Mark, but we found, you know, the intersection of our personal attraction to this material and how it informs what we do as Spiral, at Spiral, to be really important. So we thought today we would review the book and just discuss it. Does that work for you, Mark?
That works for me.
Okay. So tell me how you came to Flow. What was your first experience with it?
Yeah, I really first came across it through a friend who is a psychologist and therapist and pastor. And he was actually going through some shelves of books before a move. Mm-hmm. And I basically inherited this as part of his move. And I was just drawn to the concept of flow. At the time, the subtitle sort of gives away a little bit more. It's the psychology of optimal experience. And it sounds like a self-help book. Mm-hmm. And as Csikszentmihalyi says right away in the preface, it's not. It really is rooted in about 20 years of worldwide research on what he calls flow. So it's you know, again, it sounds like something you'd grab off the shelf at the airport and think by the end of your flight, you're going to change your life. And it's mm-hmm. just not that. But at any rate, that concept was fascinating to me and still is. Mm-hmm. How about you? Where did you encounter flow?
Well, I may have actually picked it up at the airport. I'm not sure. No, but it was a central... central idea. It was a fit very well into my graduate work. And as I shared with you, when I opened it, there was an actual plane ticket, like the ones you used to get that were hard paper. There was actually a plane ticket as my bookmark, but I must have picked this up 6-7 years ago, not only as a part of my psychology program, but also as a creative. I was looking for kind of that magic formula, right, of how to access and channel my creativity. And I felt like this would be a great read. And in reviewing it for today, I was reminded of what a good book it is, how deep it is. And how just packed with information and research and really thoughtful concepts around the idea of creativity and flow. There was a short YouTube video on him, older video, which, you know, recognized him as he's considered one of the fathers of positive psychology, which I didn't know, but now makes a lot of sense. Because these ideas are not new. I mean, as you and I noted earlier, this book was published in 1990, but his research on this goes back decades.
Right. And for those of you who may be curious about who Csikszentmihalyi is, he is definitely the founder of positive psychology. He did his undergraduate and graduate work all at the University of Chicago after immigrating from Hungary at about age 22. And that name is a classic Hungarian name, you know, and I had lived in Hungary, and it still is a tongue twister to me. But I found it kind of interesting that his name basically means sort of at the foot of St. Michael, that his last name is a village in Hungary where his family had come from. So it's just kind of interesting on that level. Very renowned both in the U.S. and in Hungary. He won all kinds of awards as late as 2011 or even later in Budapest. So he's very respected, still alive. He's in his mid-80s and is now at Claremont College, I believe. He's no longer at Chicago, but Chicago is where he did all of this research and where his research teams were based. They basically, just a little bit of the background, they interviewed and monitored, I think, thousands or 100,000 people worldwide on the basic concept of when do you feel, for lack of a better word, happy or content. And they did this with a monitoring device. It reminded me of if you've ever had sort of a cardiac issue and the doctor will give you a little device and you push a button every so often during the day. If you start to feel something kind of weird, it was similar to that. But basically, the device would sort of buzz at random periods throughout the day. And then the subject would write how they felt.
Huh.
And all of this got compiled into this great research. So that's just further background. And to me, it, I mean, the word that comes to mind is justifies it, but you want this research justified. It isn't just somebody saying, be happy. You know, you can't control the universe, control yourself, which kind of is the bottom line.
That really is the bottom line of this
book. It's the bottom line. And it is data driven. This is not, you know, what many would call pop psychology. This is true psychology. Yeah. And he weaves so much philosophy from the ancients in that it, he also shows this is not a new, what I've done is not really a discovery. It's a new way of looking at this concept of flow. But this dates all of humanity.
Right. Yeah, that's really what impressed me, because flow has become such a byword now. And that certainly was not the case when he was doing this research or even generating these results. But
right.
You know, he well, I guess we'll get into this, but he talks, I guess he almost might say his definition of flow is optimal experience.
Right.
Generating optimal experience. But the word that sticks out to me is chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of my spiritual life, and I'm sure this is not unique, but a lot of my spiritual life has been trying to find meaning in the chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a Buddhist idea of chaos being what they call the charnel ground. It's like the mud from which the lotus emerges, which is a great spiritual precept. But how do you translate that into how you actually deal with experience, with the chaos of both internal and external? So that's why I love this book, because it takes from that perspective. He talks about external and internal chaos. And kind of, even though it's not a how-to, it really does give you a roadmap from that to, okay, so how do I structure my life that creates meaning? And it's funny, he doesn't even really talk about happiness in the in the book. He talks about it at the beginning, but really he ends up saying, you know, your happiness is how you end up making sense of the chaos and making meaning out of it, which I just... From a psychological perspective, I geeked out on that, but also from a personal perspective, it's like, Okay, thank you. Thank you. I've got a roadmap now that I can take all whatever skills and tactics that have evolved in the intervening years. But now I feel like I've got kind of a structure to hang it on. Because then now it's not just, well, you just, it's all in your mindset and you think your way to happiness. You know, he's not there. Thank God. That's not where he comes from. But it is a lot more meaty.
Not at all. And as you're describing spirituality and even religion, mm-hmm. And structure, all kind of in the same breath, that's exactly at the root of the conditions for flow. Mm-hmm. And that sort of blew me away. I had never really thought of limits as being crucial mm-hmm. to success, if you will, or joy. I always thought of, oh, we need to break away all the limits and all the structure. But back to the religion, he says rituals were created to put those boundaries on. And so because we're, let's say it could be a church service or in a temple or whatever it is, you're allowed to let go because you know the ritual. And, you know, I've had so many people describe, or I've experienced this myself, you know, there may be a prayer that comes to mind. You don't even have to flinch because it's so rooted. And that to me is a form of structure. Mm-hmm. Where you're not like, wait a second, is this the red book or the blue book? How do I read the bulletin? You know, there are a lot of barriers to flow in religion, I will add, from my personal experience. But even just kind of jumping around here, but picking up on that structure, even things we do like games, chess, tennis, cards. Mm-hmm. Once you learn enough about how they work, you just let go and you enjoy them. And they're like graphs in this book about, you know, if you have low skill, low anxiety, it may be all right, but that's not flow. Mm-hmm. As you gain skill, but you're not great yet, your anxiety might skyrocket if you're playing somebody better. That isn't flow either. So mm-hmm. It's sort of getting the right fit with a tennis partner, a chess partner, maybe a religious experience. I just found it sort of oddly mind-blowing because it's so simple.
I completely agree with you. And I'm as you're talking, I'm furiously scanning my notes because he talks about later in the book, he's talking about relationships. He comes back to the idea of relationships, but he says in the context of structure, because he says religion does that. He profiles. Oh, I think it was a homeless gentleman who had admittedly a great deal of external chaos, a lot of conditions he could not control. But once he came to a religious experience and belief, it was he immersed himself in that religious experience and it created all the internal structure that he required for joy and bliss and order. And then he equates that also to like marriage and family relationships. It's like this, you know, admittedly, you cannot control your partner, you can't control your family, but you can nurture the relationships. You can create structures around that. He said, but once that structure is in place, it gives you the psychic and mental freedom to really create from. It gives you it frees up energy for the creativity. Yeah, I found it the same way. I think, you and I come at this from a similar perspective because we all are both INFPs mm-hmm. in the MBTI. And we tend to not like structure. So we tend to rail against it. And so for us, it can be very easy to decide that a lack of structure is the most freeing experience. And this would not be what he would recommend.
Right. And it really isn't. You know, once I start to impose a comfortable structure for myself, especially in the realm of creativity, and I've talked at length about my, you know, what works for me when I'm trying to write something, for example, it's wonderful. I just let go. Even if the structure is a 15-minute timer, I can let it go. I'm not obsessed over the time or producing. I simply let it go. And then by the time that timer dings, I frequently am on my merry way. I'll just keep producing. So it, you know, I've lived it out in that small way. And I do find if there's a day that I don't have a lot of external structure, it's just not good if I don't create some internal. It's just, I feel sort of mushy. Like that's the word that comes to mind because I'm not going up against the guardrails of, you know, oh, taxes are due. That's a structure. There's just no friction in a good way, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that really most surprised me, he talks about the, how the mind without any sort of structure, of course, this isn't surprising, but without focusing the mind, the reason people, you know, binge watch or overeat, addiction is formed because we haven't, in part, because we haven't created structure for our mind. And so that when it goes, it will naturally go to worries, anxieties, obsession, obsessive thoughts about negativity, or why is our relationship not working, especially in the absence of information. If there's no flow of information in a relationship, for instance, is one of the things he talks about is, you know, we're story making beings. And so our mind can just run away with us. And that's so counterproductive. And he talks about the destructuring of the mind. And so he's really an advocate for structuring your mind. And the part that surprised me was he said, you know, we'll be the, here it comes. It's just kind of like this. And my day, we had to memorize things.
Right.
You know, he's a really real advocate for memorizing stories, poetry, facts. He said, that's the information that once it's in your mind, in your brain, in your memory becomes quite the tool for giving your brain something constructive to do. When you're able to reflect on poetry, he said, like in Iceland, when the days are long and dark and the conditions inhospitable, they create a lot of poetry because they're giving their minds something to do. And I find that fascinating. Like it was a different perspective for me it's not like you must give your brain a task. It's like, no, you fill your brain with and your mind with the raw materials for it to use in creating something new.
Yes, I'm thinking of his examples of he frequently will talk about surgeons, rock climbers, dancers. These are professions or avocations, whatever you want to call them, that require such attention and enjoyment that the person becomes so absorbed in the task. And certainly in the example of a surgeon and a rock climber climbing El Capitan, without that attention, and a dancer too, depending, without that level of attention and absorption, you know, somebody's life is at stake, right? Mm-hmm. And he talks about, you know, that level of focus. That is a structure in and of itself, and it blinds oneself to any other mental chatter. You cannot perform open heart surgery and be worried about, you know, he keeps saying balancing the checkbook, you know, something like that, or, you know, what did my wife say to me today, or my partner, did I hurt their feelings, or I was really PO'd, you know, you just can't do that. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, he says that that kind of attention and enjoyment, and not surprisingly, but interestingly, can lead to addiction. Mm-hmm. Surgeons can become addicted to surgery. Mm-hmm. And he said it's not necessarily for glamour, status, money. It's for the feeling. Mm-hmm. And again, not a huge shock, but it's interesting, like, where's the fine line between absorptive enjoyment and an right. addiction?
And I guess we haven't actually described or defined flow yet. How do you understand it?
Yeah, you want to take a stab at that?
Yeah. How do you understand it as he describes it?
Well, I think it's optimal experience. I really think it is. In fact, he had a very good, he called it sort of a clinical, I don't know that I can find it right now, but it's the conditions for optimal experience.
Yeah. And as I understand it, it would be enough technical knowledge of what you're doing and the rules, combined with intense focus. And what I found right. most interesting is those are the mental pieces. And then the sense of the intense focus brings you this intense presence. Mm-hmm. So later in the book, he talks about focused attention. Oh, he talks about what he calls focusing attention on the outer world and discovery of new solutions. But how I interpret that is this intense presence. You're just really aware of what's happening. Oh, and then this responsiveness to right. being present enough and aware enough to respond to the conditions and adapt. I think that's the piece that creates the flow. Because yes. he talked about something like a cashier or a stocker or somebody working in a warehouse. They have done these motions mm-hmm. repeatedly over time, and they've created this very efficient flow of movement to save time. And within that very ordered, structured, repetitive environment, they're able to slip into flow if they're able to appreciate the moment and look for new solutions. And like, that just fascinates me. It's not just Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci or Stephen King. It's anyone with that much focus and attention and then presence and responsiveness. It's like all these things combined create that flow.
That's right. And I love that example of the person on the assembly line. And he, you know, he says in one case, somebody on that line, it became a goal to keep producing his piece faster and faster. And, you know, he uses the word, Csikszentmihalyi uses the word teleology, meaning goal, that worker could do whatever it was in 45 seconds versus mm-hmm. a minute or 90 seconds. And so you're right. He would just slip into flow right there. Another example was somebody, Csikszentmihalyi knew in an office, just a very mundane office job. When the worker got very bored, he would hum all the different parts somehow of, say, a Mozart piece, symphony, like, it was just astonishing. And that was flow. It pulled him out of the moment, but put him into this other moment of intense focus. And I will add to the list, immediate feedback is part of flow.
Yes.
A surgeon knows right away, looks like we got the cancer, looks like we've sutured him. Or I hit the tennis ball into the service part of the court, box, whatever. Sometimes the feedback is so obvious and so satisfying. And then in others, you got to wait for it. You know, he talks about the psychiatrist or psychologist. The feedback could be a facial expression or a very gradual change in behavior or attitude over time. It might not be immediate, but it's still feedback. And I know you and I bristle at the word feedback in the way that it can be delivered or handled. And at the same time, it really is critical.
It is to telling us what is working and what isn't, which is a piece of optimal experience. If it's not working, why would we continue going that way? And I mean, that's external feedback, but that's important too.
Right.
As well as the internal feedback about meaning. He closes the book by talking about making meaning. Before I get into that, can you relate that to your experience? We talked last time about your writing goal, reaching your writing goal in the November writing challenge.
Yeah, so are you asking how do I
Yeah, not to put you on the spot or anything, but where was the meaning in that for you? How did you make meaning of that experience?
All right, and yeah, just to review quickly, the National Novel Writing Month is a really an international goal of writing 50,000 words. It could be a short novel. It could be a draft of a novel. It could be poetry. It could be a grocery list. But 50,000 words in the month of November. So I wouldn't say that it's collaborative, but it is communal. My goal for me was to prove to myself that I could do it. The meaning came from that. Not so much the content, even though, of course, I wanted content to be meaningful also. So really, I had a goal of whatever it was, 1,500 words a day, something like that, for 30 days, and I did it. And the meaning I made was, I can do that. I did do that. You know, Csikszentmihalyi talks about some experiences like that are simply neutral. Oh, I did that. It could be negative. Oh, that wasn't enough. Or, oh, I did it and I still don't feel worthy. No, I felt positive. I made a positive meaning out of that. Because I had tried it a couple of times before. I had never, quote unquote, succeeded. I came pretty close, but I just didn't hit that exact number. So that's the meaning I made. And I felt, sort of loosely speaking, I had created conditions for optimal experience. And I was relying on, what does he say? Exoteleology? I mean, an external goal. And I somehow transformed that into an internal one. I felt compelled to get in here into my study or wherever I was and bang those words out every day. And he talks a lot about there is very often that balance between an external goal and an internal goal. He talks about teaching children. You may have sort of this external goal of wanting to shape minds for a better future. That's sort of external. Internally, you just may really like kids and you want to be around them. Lucky for you, you're doing both. So I think for me, and I'd love to hear your thoughts too, that's the perfect combo of I had that external goal in the case of the writing, and that created accountability. And then I had that internal, just I want to prove to myself.
I totally relate to the inner and outer balance there, because the I think we as humans do like to, well, we do like to create order and in the external environment and feel a sense of accomplishment. That's just a basic human need. But then it's meaningless unless we've set ourselves an internal intention or goal that has personal meaning for us. He talks about, let's see if I can find it. Well, yeah, he does talk about that. He calls it the sensory and the internal, kind of the balance between the two. Also, that we have skills that are both instrumental and expressive. So that would be like what the practical and expressing who we actually are. I think all of that. It's new ways of saying that internal external balance, and that it's a way that we, and that meaning is the way that we order our universe. I mean, we, you know, as, when I talk about this, I feel like it's just so basic. But we mentioned this before, you and I did off the air, that it seems really, really common sense now, but was rather revolutionary when he presented all these ideas about this balance between the internal and outternal, that's good, internal and external chaos, and making order, creating order out of those.
Right. And I want to go back to the teaching idea for just a second, because it relates to structure, particularly for children. And, you know, this is a little section called The Effects of the Family on the Autotelic Personality. That's the self-guided goal, is autotelic.
Uh-huh.
So that's like, I want to write a novel. That's pretty autotelic. But he basically is saying the conditions for children for flow are clarity, centering, which means that the parents are showing interest in what the child is doing. The child is kind of the center. So what he means there, choice. So children feel they have some choice in what they're doing. Commitment, which creates trust and safety within the family system. And then challenge, so that parents provide complex opportunities for their children. And so I think that was what 5 C's that Csikszentmihalyi uses. And I think they're perfect. And it's sort of the root of flow. You know, if you grow up under those 5 conditions, you've got that internal safety already in you. And you just grow into it. Mm-hmm. So you end up working in an office and standing up and humming all the different parts of a Mozart concerto, probably. Or climbing El Capitan, whatever it is. I think it it's crucial that not just parents, but teachers, particularly of younger children, create those five conditions.
Absolutely. And not a lot of children get that type of structure. I don't think I did, but I've definitely learned to cultivate it through my life.
Right. Sure. If kids didn't get it, I certainly think it can be cultivated. I think I did. I keep thinking of, well, how does this apply now? We're a year into a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And oddly, in the part I was reviewing for the podcast, he says, you know, people have had what we could call flow in concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentions Viktor Frankl, who was the Austrian psychiatrist. And, you know, he wrote a book about joy, I think. And he had been at a concentration camp.
Absolutely.
So you can have it anywhere. You know, he says we have survived plagues. And I thought, oh, geez, this is really oddly prescient or good timing or whatever. And, you know, I think we've had this conversation at least off air. Tons of people we both know, and maybe even ourselves, have found flow in this year.
Absolutely. You know, he talks about that later in the book. He mentions people in his study who, he'd already mentioned the homeless gentleman, but also there was a guy who was a star athlete and became paralyzed. And so, you know, whatever meaning and purpose he had for his life completely had to shift. But it's in that trauma, in that experience of external chaos where you lose control, that suddenly you've got to find it internally. If you've been so outwardly focused that you don't have any inner intrinsic goal or intention, that suddenly you have to find it. Otherwise, you become the victim to whatever external event comes at you in life. And now we're even beyond flow. You are no longer in any sort of internal flow and not likely to experience any meaning or joy or happiness.
Exactly. And you're not allowing yourself to have any agency. And I think what you just said is like tenet number one of psychology, period. If you can't find meaning or self-rootedness in yourself, you know, that's rule number one. You've got to.
Yes, and that takes me back to who we are. As Spiral Leadership Group, and that we've maybe said this before, but Spiral is based on the idea of, well, the double labyrinth. You cycle in reflection, and then you cycle out and take those learnings epiphanies into the world. You know, there's a saying that says, if I do not go within, I go without. You have nothing to bring to the world if you don't have enough self-awareness to know who you are and what's important to you and what is that intrinsic intention and goal. And so, yeah, it's the root of what we do here at Spiral, is to help anyone, leaders, well, and we're all leaders, but leaders in any capacity, do the inner work of personal awareness so that their outer work does flow with meaning and purpose.
That's right. And matching your internal world with your external world and vice versa. You know, it's almost the same imagery that Csikszentmihalyi uses of that balance of the outward and inward states of flow. And, you know, it doesn't mean it's a one and done. You know, it's a messy process to do that. And it's easy to revert under stress. collectively, we have been under stress for a year, and there's no physical escape from it, right? You can't just say, well, I'm going to go to Europe for 2 months. You can't do that. You can't escape this. If I'm focused on the pandemic, you can't escape it. So the escape is internal. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily mean Netflix. And, you know, I say that sort of joking because it's been a lifeline for me.
Yeah, and I'm not a TV watcher, but I just finished The Crown. Like, I finished 4 seasons of The Crown, and well, that's a long time for some people, but it took me 2 months.
Yeah.
And that's been, you know, sometimes those are lifesavers. But I'm glad you mentioned stress, because he talks about stress. He says, you know, you've got outer resources to help you deal with stress. And then you've got the inner resources, who you are. And then you've got your strategies. And the strategies is where, you know, our work comes in. But I love this list he cited. He talked about our inner strategies as courage, resilience, perseverance, mature defense, and transformational coping. And I would add, transformational coping is again more skills of being present and attending and looking for solutions. So all those skills that are vital for us to continue to develop, especially right now.
Absolutely. And what a great list. I mean, it feels uplifting just to hear it.
Yeah, it's definitely what I think of Brené Brown when I hear that. And she's not alone in that type of work with those basic skills that will help us cope with this incredible global chaotic stressor that we're all experiencing, and to do the internal work to shift and adapt to that.
Absolutely. And, you know, this may or may not be a leap, but I don't think it is. You know, I've mentioned before, at least to you off air, you know, along the lines of the creativity that's coming out of this time. You know, I have a friend who is a very gifted painter, who's a lawyer by profession. He was trained, I mean, he took painting lessons for years as a child. He's come back to it. He's painting every day, you know, and that wasn't happening a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, and I could ask, but I'm speculating here, I think that kind of turn towards creativity is a form of resilience. I think it's putting himself in a flow state.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about 15 minutes at a time, probably, for some of these. Very small, quick watercolors quite often. And sometimes, you know, 8x10 oil, mm-hmm. you know, it's the range. But you can put yourself in flow for 15 minutes, you know, and he's doing his job. His kids are either at home or they're finally back in school. I don't remember. But I've seen a lot of other examples of, if we're thinking of creativity in kind of those literal terms, right? Producing, painting, mm-hmm. writing. There's so much coming out of this time.
Yes. Yes. And hopefully transforming the way we approach art and beauty and generating more of that regardless of our circumstances.
Right.
I think my takeaway from this is the availability of that creativity and to not resist the structure, to not you know, when you were talking earlier about creating the structure for yourself about writing. My work, a lot of my work has recently gotten very busy, and I'm not naturally an organized person, but I can create some structure well, the busier it's gotten, the more structure I've created.
Mm-hmm.
And it is freeing. I feel so much better because when that list is done, it's done. And then I feel free to do other things. But within that list, knowing that I've got enough structure to keep things from not getting done, like the things will get done, I feel the freedom within each task to enjoy it in whatever way makes sense for me. So, you know, I find this whole book kind of giving me a new perspective on how to create the structure for myself that generates more flow. And, you know, I think it's frequently an oxymoron, but not here. He makes a very strong case for creating more order. And I guess it also reminds me that to mind my mind, mm-hmm. to be more intentional with my my inner mental life, knowing that that has a big impact on how much meaning I create for myself.
I'm thinking for myself, you know, one of the things I've mentioned that's come out of the time where we're really at home all the time is our walking, particularly mm-hmm. in the evening together. You know, my partner is, his structure is he wants the 10,000 steps in a day. That mm-hmm. it's just, you don't even have to think about it. You check your pedometer. Do I have it? Do I not? It's so simple. And you're not thinking about, oh, did I get cardio? You just do the 10,000 steps.
Does he make you keep walking if he's close?
No, but I can see why you would ask. So that's just, that creates enough of kind of a shell.
Mm-hmm.
And then it is a more creative process. Well, do we want to go down that way today? We haven't been that way in a while. Or is so-and-so at home? Should we walk and try to see if we can visit? And, you know, a year ago and more, we weren't even walking together. So it's, and it sounds so kind of basic, but again, we keep saying that it, a lot of it is.
Yeah. I think that's the I'm going to put it this way, the tricks our mind wants to play on us. I would call it our ego, that it has to be complicated or it has to be grandiose, and that it's absolutely the opposite.
You're right. And as I was reflecting on the book, I kept thinking the book flow is like a way more sophisticated and elaborate way of saying create a SMART goal. I don't like that acronym, and it's kind of useful. So it is,
well, help me with that because I'm not familiar with that. Others might not be either.
I thought I remembered. Okay, a SMART goal is something, I don't remember the S, it's measurable, attainable, realistic, and time sensitive.
Oh, okay.
I have no idea what the S is. I knew it this morning. And again, I kind of think of that kind of acronym as sort of cliche.
Mm-hmm.
I much would rather read flow, and at the same time, it's got its place.
Mm-hmm.
So if your goal is all those things plus whatever the S is, it sets you up for flow.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm learning to play a scale on the piano, there are ways I can measure that success. Is that attainable? Yes. Mm-hmm. Is it realistic? Yes. Even if I need a teacher or a YouTube video. Is it time either sensitive or certain? Yeah, I could say I want to learn to play a scale in 3 weeks. And it takes away that burdensome, overwhelming feeling, like you're saying, like our minds tell us it's got to be this insane goal. No, it doesn't. I know a coach and psychologist who says, why would you make, she kind of plays devil's advocate. She kind of says, why would you make a realistic goal? Why would you make a goal that's something you should probably already either have done or can do? I thought that was a very good question.
Huh.
But in the light of flow, make it realistic.
Yeah. Otherwise, you set yourself up for frustration.
Frustration,
if it just seems insurmountable.
Failure. Mm-hmm. He talks a lot about, you know, especially musicians, like if you're playing a piece that's too easy, you and I both play piano. I'm sure we can both relate to this. If you're playing a piece that's too easy, it may be sort of semi-enjoyable. It may mm-hmm. be boring. Pull out a piece that's too hard. I know what I do. I get about three measures in and put it away. It's frustrating.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that's an argument for breaking it down into doable pieces.
And sort of the, what is it, Goldilocks, you know, the just right.
Yeah. So I have I'm going to turn left here because I just finished The Crown. I'm sure I'm not the first person that as I'm watching The Crown, I'll be fact checking it. So I'll be mm-hmm. Googling, you know, and,
I
ran across one little piece on Diana, Princess of Wales that was not in The Crown, but I ran across it as I was Googling. She and her husband were, somewhere, I think they were Italy. Anyway, they were at an arts school and they challenged Charles to play cello because he had studied cello. So he played a few notes and they invited Diana to sit down and play the piano. And you know, the reporters are like, what is she going to play? Is she even going to do it? No, she sits down and she plays like 8 or 10 bars of Rachmaninoff.
What?
Yeah, exactly. And that, and I was like, and you know, she got about a little, when she first kind of ran into a problem, she stopped. But like that just blew everyone away because like, she had it and she sat down and did it. And that was actually inspiring to me. I was like, you know, it wasn't related to her job. It was something she enjoyed, something she was good at. And when presented with the opportunity, she's like, oh yeah, I'll sit down and play some Rachmaninoff. Like, hey, I need to learn to do that just because it would feel good to be able to do that.
I had no idea. And yeah, what a great reason to do something, right? It mm-hmm. feels good. It's fun.
Yeah. It's enjoyable.
I may notch it down a few and go back to like the minute waltz or something, but
yeah, I'm, that's pretty cool. As you know, I'm restarting my love affair with piano. So I may go learn some scales.
Hannon.
That's right.
The Virtuosic Pianist.
That's it.
I think that's the name of that one. Ooh.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this has been a fascinating, at least for us, discussion of flow.
I found it fascinating.
Thank you, Mark, for covering this book with me. Being fascinating, yes.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
I think this is definitely going to impact and inform our work with individuals and groups in terms of how to find that optimal space of creativity and productivity in a way that is just brings a lot of meaning and depth to our lives.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I want to dedicate today's episode to my dear friend and mentor, Laura Bearing, who passed away yesterday at the age of 60. She was a life coach to me actually when I was in grad school. But the longer I've known her, the wider her circle grows. Like there are random people in my life who happen to know her. I was in grad school and one of my classmates had worked with her. Not only that, but she was a brilliant, bright light for creativity, for the flow of creative experience, for finding meaning, for embracing who you are and speaking your truth and allowing your true voice to be heard in the world. And the last time I spent time with her, she invited me to her rural farm and showed me at least 200 paintings she had been doing with an acrylic process. And so I think of her painting and her prolific creativity, because that's just who she was. And she embraced and allowed herself to do that. And she taught others the same. So if you know someone who's a creative or you're a creative, please, I encourage you, let your creativity flow. Let your true voice of who you are flow through the structures you create for yourself to allow that to happen. And if you have a mentor you admire and appreciate, let them know. Thank you, everyone, for Mark Elberfeld and myself. This has been Spiral Leadership Radio, and we will see you here again next time. Have a great day.